Welcome to the Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians podcast. GSASEP represents emergency physicians who work in the federal government, including active duty military, National Guard, and military reserves, as well as the Veterans Administration, Indian Health Service, and other federal agencies. Our mission is advancing emergency care for America's heroes. In this podcast, we bring you lectures and conversations with leaders in federal emergency medicine to help you better care for your patients and lead your departments. The views expressed on this podcast are personal views and do not represent the views of the Department of Defense, any branch of the military, or the federal government, and they do not constitute endorsement of any product by any of these entities.
But I'm also an incredible living example of what not to do sometimes. And so I think it's just as important to share challenges and backward steps as it is to share forward steps. So I'm going to go through kind of some things very quickly. I'm going to ask some questions and you can answer them in your mind. And then I'm going to walk through kind of a timeline for me quickly. And then I'm really going to open it up to questions and discussion. And because there are so many senior, very experienced people kind of lurking in the background there, if they want to chime in, I would kind of love that as well, because I think these sessions are very helpful when we have dialogue about different ways we problem solve in our careers. All right, so let's kick it off. When you are like young, everybody kind of points out to you that there's these things you're supposed to do in your career, this kind of like stepwise approach to like career progression. I will tell you, that's me in the sand trap. I don't think I ever went in the right order of anything the entire way. Somehow it worked out for me. I wouldn't change a thing about my career, but I will tell you, when somebody is like, okay, you need to do this, and then you need to do this, and then you need to do this, those are good guidelines. In my experience, you have to do what fits right in your life at the time. And I think probably some sensitivities to that as a woman who is also, you know, if you're looking at being a parent, or maybe if you have something going on with family members where you need to care for elderly parents, or, you know, anything where life just doesn't fit with the linear approach to the military career. I always like to encourage people, that's okay. Like, there is still a very fulfilling way to navigate your career that doesn't always have to be in a linear direction. And sometimes the sand traps are more fun than the path. So I kind of like this visual. So I'm just going to ask these questions, and unfortunately I can't see faces and I can't see, answers as I would anything. But answer them in your head. So, you know, from the time I graduated med school till I retired in 2020, just curious, how many times do you think I was actually assigned to an emergency department, or how many years I was actually in a MTF, emergency department? And I'll come back to that. How many times do you think I got my first choice of jobs or the location where I wanted to be? How many times did I actually get training to do the job that I was supposed to do? Like, for example, the brigade surgeon course before being a brigade surgeon, or, getting any sort of training on how to be a residency director before I had an RRC visit. I'll talk about some of that stuff. How many times did I screw up enough to get fired? That'll be a fun one to talk about. How many jobs did I dislike? Ask me that when we get to the end. How many of my own evaluations did I write in a, and I'll go all the way back. I'll go back to a 30-year career, because I actually, you know, started in the military before medical school with West Point. So I'll count that as well, because we had evaluations back then too. And then how far in advance do you think I plan my retirement? You know, they talk about 18 months out, start thinking about it kind of thing. So how long do you think I did to do that? And what do I have to say about that? All right. So here's a timeline, and I'm going to fly through it, because when I get through it, I'm going to talk about some principles I earned. But then I want to use this timeline as a chance to kind of open up the door for some questions. All right. So a lot of people don't know this, but so I went to the military academy, but believe it or not, I was actually kicked out of the military academy for a year. So I started my career off stellar. I was kicked out and let back in, and, you know, still went out swinging 30 years later. So you can come back from something like that. Then I went to USIS and I managed to get pregnant the end of my third year. And if, I did not lie about my daughter's age to get her into daycare, I would not have graduated on time. So there was another time where life just was not going on the timeline I planned. Then during my fourth year, I decided I wanted to do emergency medicine. I'd already matched to family medicine. So I went and I did that internship. And when I left that to do EM, they took my top block eval and decided to change it to a center of mass because I was abandoning the specialty. I saw Marco on the line. I would love for him to chime in because Marco was actually fighting for me to be a resident at Darnell. And I was denied because I was overqualified because I'd already done an internship. And at that time, Darnell was just a 1-2-3 program. So that plan didn't work out for me. So I went to the first Cav, and when I got my orders, I was supposed to go to second brigade, which was a non-deploying brigade. I had, you know, a baby at that time and thought I was going to be, you know, living in Fort Hood doing the brigade surgeon thing. When I signed into Fort Hood, they said, we reassign you. You need to be on a plane to Bosnia in 3 days. So I had 3 days to find childcare and a house and get on a plane. And then when I came back, I then switched brigades and was a flight surgeon. And right after I found out I was going to the flight surgeon course, I found out I was pregnant again. So I hid my pregnancy while I navigated the flight surgeon course. And then when I got to my unit, I couldn't do anything because I was pregnant. You know, I mean, obviously I could still practice medicine, but I couldn't fly. So I didn't get to do any of the fun stuff. And then I did my ER residency at BMC, which, as I mentioned, I was trying to go to Fort Hood because I wanted to train with Marco and all the smart people there. So BMC was not my first choice, but I had a great residency there. Then I wanted to do critical care. And back then they were not allowing critical care, emergency medicine to get boarded in critical care. So at the time, Dave Dell'Agostino was a consultant and he's like, we're not going to support critical care. Why don't you go do toxicology? Wasn't what I wanted to do. I was kind of mad at him at the time. It ended up being the best thing that ever happened to me. So I owe him a thank you, but it really wasn't what I wanted to do. Cause I was, didn't know anything about it, but turned out to be a good thing. So then, let me talk about fellowship. Cause when I was in fellowship, your contract says that you cannot volunteer or you cannot be paid. So technically when I was in fellowship, I could not work in the ER, because it would either be volunteer work or paid work. I think they've revised the contract since then, but I actually had to like go through all kinds of hoops to just be allowed to work in the ER while I was in fellowship. So that was a very interesting, fight as well. Then off I went to Madigan, and I was supposed to deploy for OEF, all excited about it. The week before I deployed, I broke my leg, and I had to tell one of my very favorite colleagues that he was going in my place. What an asshole I was. Fortunately, he took my 6-month deployment, and I took his 13-monther. So it ended up being fair in the end, but boy, did I feel like a piece of crap. When I had to tell him he had to leave his wife and kid, in a week because of my bad decision-making on a ski slope. After I came back from Bosnia, I went to be a PD at Fort Hood, probably one of my favorite jobs. And there's several Fort Hood people on the call, and it's those people that, that really made that a special assignment for me. During that time, I went back over to Iraq and got divorced. So kind of figured, you know, out a new lifestyle for myself as a single parent at that time. Then I got my job at SOCAF, and I will tell you how I got it. I happened to be in the room when somebody called Steve Tanksley to offer him the job, and he didn't want it because he didn't want to move overseas. And so I literally got that job because I overheard a conversation. I was in the room and was like, can I do that? And somebody really put their neck out for me because there wasn't room for women at the time in those jobs. And so it was actually the chief of staff at SOCAF that was like, I don't know why we're not taking, you know, this person, let's go ahead and open this up to women. So that was, that was pretty cool. I got into a little bit of hot water there. I actually didn't find out about it until later. I had bought some lab equipment to take to the continent with me. And it was kind of progressive point of care testing at the time. Well, if any of you have heard of the company Theranos, I'm now a witness for Elizabeth Holmes probably going to jail someday for using bad lab equipment. So that's another story I can happily tell you about. When I left SOCAF, I did a sports medicine fellowship. I like sports med, but I realized I didn't want to do it full time. It's very procedurally based and I like it, but I just found driving an ultrasound all day wasn't my thing. So I pursued something and then I realized I'm not sure I like this very much. And then I went back to USIS, which I loved. And there was the next time that I almost got fired from the military. I got picked to be the CENTCOM surgeon and I didn't want to do it. And I didn't want to move. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And they said, okay, well then pay your ADSO back and you can leave. So that, you know, here they were going to foot me with however many years I had left on my ADSO. So that was an almost fired from the Army kind of moment. And then I left USIS and went into the special operations world, doing some kind of nuanced jobs there. And just, you know, I loved every minute of that, but I will tell you, I was in an 04 billet. I was an 06 in an 04 billet. So I completely took a step backwards in my career to do a job I loved. And then, you know, they put the here, fill this out for your, you know, general officer promotion packet. They put that on my desk like three times and I managed to fill it out in the most sloppily manner ever, because I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. Then I was supposed to go to the UAE and I was over there for 6 months, TDY, waiting for my orders. Military couldn't seem to pull it together to get my family over there with me. So I passed up on that job and they said, well, if you're not going to do it in the timeline we want to do, then you're welcome to get out. So 3 months after, I thought I was going to be moving to the UAE, I retired and was out of the Army, and then COVID hit and I was in New York running a field hospital. And that is that, you know, that's the blur of my career. Now, you don't care about my career. It doesn't matter. Every one of us has our own career and our pathway. The reason I walk through all of that is, I don't know if you paid attention, pretty much nothing along the way was planned other than my assignment to USIS. You know, I always knew I wanted to get back to USIS someday. Linda Lawrence was my mentor when I was a student and she was faculty there. And that always stuck in my head of like, wow, what a big difference you can make in somebody's life at USIS. So that was an intentional assignment. But I wanted to point out to everybody that none of this was planned, but all of it was open doors that somehow I was fortunate enough to walk through and ended up having great experiences. So, you know, when you saw that slide of how many jobs did I hate? Absolutely zero. I loved every single one of my jobs. Surprisingly so. And most of it was because of the people that I had the opportunity to work with. So what did I learn along the way? You know, master the boondoggle. These are a couple fun things that I got to do. And I'm just going to throw them up there. If somebody wants to ask me about them at the end, I'm happy to talk about them. One of the things I want to point out that was probably the highlight of my career was doing medical coverage for the POW MIA recovery missions. If you've never heard of the Defense Accountability Agency, they literally go around the world and look for remains of lost service members. And so I did one of those missions. And I will say, if you can ever get on one of those, make your way onto it. It is incredibly rewarding. And it's a great workout because you just dig all day long. So you get to play in the dirt for fun. So that was a whirlwind. I'm gonna go through the principles that I learned in my career, and then I'll answer the questions. So one thing that I always know is you got to know the rules. You have to know what your job is, what the rules are, what the right and left boundaries are. But then sometimes you got to break them. And you have to know why you're breaking them, and you have to be very deliberate when you're doing that, and you have to inform the right people that I'm going to break a rule. And I'll give you an example. There were times when I was operating in Africa where I knew I was violating certain, you know, regulations. And I went to my commander and I was like, this is what we need to do. And this is why, and it's the only way to mitigate this risk. So, you know, I just really learned to communicate when you're breaking the rules, and have a really good reason, but you have to know the rules before you know you're breaking them. And in line with that, when you're trying to do something and somebody tells you no, listen, why are they telling you no? Is it because you just want something personally for yourself? Or if it's something that is for the good of the mission or good of other people, then you need to articulate that better. You need to write your justification better or explain your justification better, because it's not getting across. Because I guarantee there are money and resources everywhere. You just need to go find them. So if you believe in what you're doing and somebody tells you no, then you just need to keep working on that justification to support what it is you're asking for. That's in line with know your budget and where the money comes from. I will say that the thing that probably put me ahead in my career the most times is I really did learn where the money is and where it hides and how to explain to a commander which bucket of money I was using and how we were going to get something donated from somewhere else. The best example of this was when I was in SOCAF. You know, we didn't have any evacuation platforms. So I had guys spread all over the continent with evacuation times that were upwards of 36 hours. And you know, I got to the point where we would literally land in airfields and I would walk around and look at all the aircraft in these random airports in Africa. And I'd go introduce myself to whoever owned that plane just to make friends, just in case I ever needed them. And I was in Niger and happened to come across a plane that was parked on the runway. And I started asking questions of like, whose plane is that? And it turned out it was a Department of State plane that nobody was using. And then you're like, well, why aren't they using it? And then I found out that nobody had ever purchased the maintenance package for the plane. So literally it was like a plane sitting on a runway in Africa that was brand new that somebody just didn't fill out the right paperwork to use. So of course I'm like, can I have it? and, you know, figured out the process to do that. So, you know, filled out probably a stack of paperwork this big to have this plane donated from the Department of State to the country of Niger. And we built an evac platform around it. And it was very doable. You just had to fill out the paper and write the justification. But it comes with like opening your eyes and seeing what your resources are and knowing that there's all these various pots of money out there. And you have to like, you have to be willing to stick your hand in the pot and grab it or else somebody else will. So the other piece I like to point out is you are a cog in the machine. And so when you are asking for things, everything you're asking for should be, you know, for the good of the machine or, you know, somewhat in there. We all have our personal needs and our personal interests, but at the end of the day, we're in the military and it's this big, you know, machine that keeps moving forward with or without us. And that may sound very, very heartless, but it's the reality of the situation. You know, the day I got out of the military, it didn't miss me. You know, it kept on moving just like it did when I was in it, and it's still doing stuff. And I think the earlier you embrace that in your career is that you're a replaceable part, and there's somebody that's going to come along and do great things. They might not look exactly like you did, but there's really great people always coming. And that's what we should be building. We should be building this self-sustaining, self-building machine all the time. And so be very careful about, you know, personal interests versus organizational interests. Now, on the flip side of that, look out for each other because the machine is not looking out for you. So, you know, as peers, as colleagues, as mentors, as mentees, we all have to look out for each other because the machine doesn't care and we're the only ones who really can take care of each other. The next kind of thing I wanted to kind of point out is sometimes you really got to know when you have to put yourself out there as a leader, kind of, you know, take that big bold step and step forward and say, I got it. And then when are the times when you just need to get in line and do what you're being told and be a follower? I struggled with that a lot. I mean, anybody who knows me knows I'm not very good at keeping my mouth shut and doing as I'm told. And I had to learn. I kind of got put in my place a couple times along the way. And, you know, I would say whichever end of the spectrum you fall on, you know, if you're like me and far on the right side and always the one kind of being, you know, a problem child in the front, check yourself back a little bit. If you're on the other end of that spectrum and you like to just kind of fall in line and not be the standout one, you know, every once in a while, dip your toe out, see what it feels like out there. And I would say just try and, you know, try and autocorrect to which end of the spectrum you live on. We need both. We need both types of people, but, you know, leaders need to learn to operate in their discomfort zone as well. I just felt like I had to throw this in here because this is something that I saw at the very end of my career that really just made me check myself. So this is General Nagata. He's, look at his chest. Like, I don't have to say any more than look at his chest, but he retired as a 3-star out of Special Operations Command. And, I did his retirement physical for him, and he doesn't mind me sharing this at all. When he was getting ready to retire for his retirement ceremony, he wanted his command sergeant major to deliver his ceremony. And in the great big, you know, world of the Army and protocol, the protocol office for the Army refused to host his ceremony if he had an enlisted person deliver his ceremony. And, you know, for the general officers, when they retire, it's like this big deal with the protocol office, and it's, you know, it's funded, and there's all this fanfare that goes along with it. And they literally were going to deny this 3-star his promotion ceremony because he insisted on having an enlisted member be his keynote speaker at his ceremony. And he, you know, he stuck with it. He ended up not having a sponsored retirement. But I thought that was just such a shining example of, you know, like, nobody in this system is special, you know, and there's these rules, and all of us fall victim to the rules sometimes that are just nonsensical. And so, you know, we just try and leave it a little better than what we found it. But yeah, I it really made me check myself when you kind of are get that sense of entitlement of like, you know, I'm a colonel, I get this, or I'm a doctor, I get this. And I'm like, you know, here's this 3-star who couldn't even get his retirement ceremony after 37 or 38 years of service, you know, couldn't even get what he wanted at his retirement ceremony. So it really was an entitlement check for me. And this is kind of jumping topics a little bit, but I think, you know, one of the things that we all struggle with is trying to find that balance between being a doctor and being a military officer. But I think it's a really natural fit to be the link between the operational world and the clinical world. You know, like I think those two things are naturally married. You know, if you really care about your guys that are in the operational world, that is where, you know, being a physician comes alive, because you get to care for them. You don't just do medicine, you actually get to care for them. And so I really encourage everybody to explore those linkages, which I think it's, as ER docs, you know, like, if I'm not sticking in a chest tube or starting a central line, what am I doing? I think there's a lot of value in being, you know, the person that looks out for them. And then also does the operational planning to make sure that everything is well prepared to do the best we can for them in any circumstance. So this comes to like my next point is that, you know, practicing medicine is just not it doesn't always equal, you know, caring for people. And I would say, you know, really check yourself sometimes and say, am I caring? Medicine, I don't like where it's going. You know, I'm starting a company because I don't like where it's going, and I want to do something to change it. And I find sometimes medicine asks us to do things that they don't feel right. They don't feel right in caring for the person, kind of thing. And you know, I just kind of encourage everyone to examine like why they're in medicine, why they're in the military, what their beliefs are on taking care of people, and really, you know, really continue to challenge where the system tries to take us. Because I think we have to own this as physicians. I think, you know, it's easy to get into protocols and rules and finances and billing and, you know, all these things that just move us further and further away from compassionate care. And so, you know, I just have to put that plug in because it's really an important part of my life right now of trying to go back to actually caring for people. And in doing that throughout your military career, nothing will serve you better than developing people around you and then growing this very deep network. Because as you saw you know, throughout my career, it was really the people that make your career. You know, the jobs come and go, but the people really matter. And you know, I mean, I can go down the list of attendees in this actual lecture and tell you how probably I think 80% of them have touched my career in a way that was so meaningful, and I'm so grateful for them. So please, all of you, thank you for being part of my career, because it wouldn't have been the same without you. But that will continue post-career. I mean, I'm really, you know, we're tapping into our networks now for my current company, and it's just fun. It's fun to have these people you trust that you can like move on to a different phase of your life with and be able to connect and do great things with them. So develop that now. And this, you know, this is just a little bit of me of like, you know, you're in the military, you know, and, but I think all of us like to be unique, you know, we all like to stand out in our own ways. And so I think it's really important to understand yourself and understand where you fit in with the organization, and then what it is about you that is unique that truly makes the organization better. And so in order to do that, you have to understand the uniformity piece, be able to be uniform when you need to, and then be able to be unique when the situation calls for a unique skill. And then I already addressed this. Careers don't always go in a linear manner. You can go down, you can go up, you can go sideways. It's all okay. It'll work itself out. And then probably, I think this is my last one, is most of your growth is going to occur when you're uncomfortable. If there's a job that scares you, or if you think you're going to go to a place where there's a lot of uncertainty, you really grow professionally when you take on the hard stuff and do the things that are unfamiliar. But, you know, have a support network when you do that. And like I said, the people that are kind of attending this lecture, a lot of them were mine. And then the last one is retirement's really nice. Staying until retirement. It's really nice to wake up and go, I took a breath and I got paid today. So that was kind of my last take home point, is if anybody's considering getting out, everybody has their own life goals, but it really is nice to get paid to breathe. And now that was my whirlwind. And I really want to take questions. So I guess Grace, you've been kind of monitoring the chat board. So I will be happy to field questions. I tried to kind of fly through that and open it up and say, you know, what are people's thoughts?
Absolutely, ma'am. And thank you very much for that presentation. I had several of my own personal questions, but I guess those are probably best accomplished over a beer telling a couple of those stories. So the first question comes from Major Lyon. How did you know when it was time to get out, and what really was your cue?
So that's a great question. So as I mentioned, you know, I had planned to go to the UAE and was going to stand up the trauma center there. Loved my team, loved the job, was over there TDY for 6 months. I was supposed to get 2-year PCS orders, with my daughter accompanied, and the military couldn't get out of its own way and get my daughter, her passport in time to start school. And I had kind of reached that point in my career where, I had sacrificed my family over and over and over and over again. And I finally just said, today's the day I'm going to say no. And also it was also my commitment was up, so I could say no. So, you know, I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have I was blessed with a commitment that didn't give me choices. So I think it's much harder for people that don't have a commitment. You know, my commitment took me all the way up to my retirement. So I think my choices were easier. But I will say, you know, that was a line in the sand moment for me, because it was just so ridiculous that I was kind of done. I think you get to a point where you feel, you've given and you've served and you've done good things. And I also started to feel old. As I taught people, I couldn't relate as well. And I felt like it was about time for me to go to pasture and let somebody that was fresher and closer to the issues, step in. So it's kind of a combination of those two things of feeling like it's time. You know, it was time for me to let more talented and more, you know, folks that are closer to the fight step into some of the things I was doing.
Thank you for that humble opinion there, ma'am. The next question comes from Colonel Lee. And he specifically says, thank you for your perspective and an amazing career and experiences. His question is, what non-medical experience or training has unexpectedly served you well in your life?
Ooh, Max Lee throwing down the fire with some questions here. So I will say, and this is, it's actually in everything I ever write. You know, when you go places, you have to write your leadership philosophy. And when I was at USIS, I had to write my educational philosophy. And it's always founded on the words of my powerlifting coach in college. Coach Paul Christopher, he told me one day, I was being a little whiny punk. And he's like, you know, Missy, if you're not sore every day for the rest of your life, you're not working hard enough. And obviously that was about weightlifting and working a little harder, but I really took that to heart in terms of being, you know, tackling the intellectually hard things, emotionally hard things, and being uncomfortable because that's where growth occurs. And, you know, I still credit him to this day. I adore this man because he was a philosophy professor at West Point, and I never forgot that quote. And so yeah, I learned it in the squat rack. And anybody who knows me in my weightlifting, you know, life knows the best lessons are learned in the weight room.
Absolutely. And a comment here from Major Kalen, who's currently deployed, she appreciates your amazing career and your rule breaking has made a huge difference. And she also would like to mention that they are very proud of the plane.
Yay. Yeah, I have to give a thank you to a lot of people. There were several people in the Air Force actually who built the program. Alvin was probably, you know, he's the co-author on the papers I wrote for that program. And so I definitely have to give him credit because they really built the medevac program around the plane. And so again, back to, you know, forming a team of people that are able to do the things you're not able to really, you know, prove to work well for me and understanding the joint world, you know, like, so back to kind of Max Lee's question, I think what non-medical thing of the more you, and USIS really set us up for this of understanding the other services and what their capabilities are and what they're good at versus what your service might not focus on as much, allowed me to tap into the other services and capitalize on, oh, they know how to do this really well, so I'll ask them to help me so we get a better end product. And I think we're getting better at that now. JTS, you know, has really set the example for that. And there's a lot of more inter-service collaboration. So that would be, I guess, something that's a little bit more sophisticated than my weight room example. But USIS really helps with that of building these, you know, cross-service awareness so that you can tap into other resources.
Hey, Missy. So I just want to let you know, so Linda Lawrence is on the call also. She's watching with Andrea, so she says hi as well. And Marco posted to everyone that you did a fantastic job, but really not a no-brainer for you to do something like this for us. So there's a couple more questions that we were going to ask you. So looking back at your illustrious career and your timeline for everything, is there anything that you can think of that you could have done or may have done to help you transition to your civilian now job and career?
I'm actually still in the phase of learning, to be a civilian. So it's just funny. I just actually got off the phone with a bunch of venture capitalists. I know nothing about the business and finance world. And this year has been like this, you know, I feel like I'm a resident again, trying to like learn a new language. I would have paid a lot more attention to like the healthcare business side of things. Like I really wish I would have learned a lot more along the way because I'm taking a crash course in it right now. The other thing is like being aware of how culturally indoctrinated you are in the military. You do not realize your language and your mannerisms and some of the phrases you use are so military. And then when you get in a non-military setting, it can be really, some people find it charming, other people find it off-putting, but I think you have to be very self-aware, you know, for me, it's how aggressive I come across or how like, you know, structured when I really like, I just don't see myself as that at all, but I really had to edit, you know, some emotional intelligence on how you come across to others, having that military background and just the words we choose and some of the lingo and stuff like that. So I think that's been the steepest learning curve for me, as a civilian.
Oh, so that's really great advice for all of us thinking about, like, as far as the transition and knowing, you know, that it's in the future somewhere, whether it be, you know, 1 year for some of us, 5 years for the 10-year plan for some other people. So
can I add something else to that, though?
Absolutely.
You know, I would say, you know, embrace your military culture, because I will say, like, in this latest, you know, venture that I'm doing with Homefront Health, people love it. They kind of find it interesting, and you forget how small the military presence is in the greater American, you know, in the whole US. Like we're a very small thing to the big wide world out there. And so, you know, I'm certainly a lot, I used to always kind of be like, I'm not going to wear my uniform, you know, but actually now in this new world, it's like people really like to hear about it. They like some of the strengths we bring. So on the flip side, while you have to be aware and allow for it, be proud of it and wear it, you know, wear it well.
Thanks. And so you also went over, know when to hold them, know when to fold them kind of thing. And so this year has been extremely stressful, you know, during the COVID situation. And, you know, and you have been out in the civilian world on this and transitioning to all of this, knowing all of like stress management techniques, other than the physical portion of it and bodybuilding and all that stuff. Is there anything else that you suggest just to keep yourself focused as an emergency medicine physician through all of these changes and military career opportunities?
I don't think I'm going to say anything different that isn't said in every forum on this. Is outsource what you can. And it's okay to not, you know, it's sometimes 50% is okay. And I think giving yourself the grace to be able to say, I can't be good at everything. I'm going to pick what I want to be good at. I'm going to outsource what I can. And then, you know, your support network, whatever that looks like, keep it close. Keep it really close.
All right. And so if there are anybody else in the chat, so either type your question in the chat, or if you want to say hi to Missy, and then we have a question and answer box just on the bottom, just to let anybody know if they want to ask a question about here.
Ma'am, I do have a question. You specifically said several times how you have recovered from difficult points in your career. You spoke about some grit and some resiliency in there. What would you say would be the most important piece of that moving forward? Because a lot of us now feel like we are in a one shot, one fail kind of military. So what would you say would be the one thing or the one trait that you've really found to be able to move forward out of those difficult circumstances?
That's a really good question. And I, you know, there's several like very discrete instances where, you know, I was either in trouble or I was told I was not as good as I thought I was. And I, you know, so I'm going to call out, Colonel John Lammy was my DCCS when I was, in Baghdad, during the surge. And, you know, I'll never forget this. Like I was crushing it there. I mean, we were doing 60 to 80 traumas a day, you know, running that room. You're just, you know, like insanely working, doing a great job. We had great outcomes. You know, I had all the surgeons like stand where I wanted them to stand, and like, you know, like things were going in my head amazing. And I felt like I'd master that. And I'll never forget this. When I got my evaluation, I sat down with Colonel Lammy, and he gave me, you know, a center of mass in the Army. That's like a, you're good, but you're not great thing. And I was pissed. Oh my gosh. I was so like, what are you talking about? This is like the pinnacle of like emergency medicine, and I'm crushing it, you know? And I was so hurt by that. And I love this man because he was the first person in my career who was brave enough to tell me I had room for improvement. He really said, he's like, here's the thing. You don't have to be all that all the time. At the time it was kind of hard to hear. But he really was trying to get the point across of like, there's a time to dial it up, and then there's a time to kind of, you know, run it, let it just kind of run on its own and not be always pushing, you know. Now, obviously this was a high tempo environment, so, you know, it's hard to turn it off, but his advice was really well taken. I remembered that because sometimes as a leader, it's very hard to look your, you know, subordinate in the face and go, this is what you need to do better on. And it's often a very soft skill. It's not like a, hey, do your charts on time, or, you know, show up for work on time. It's a, you have this character trait that's getting in the way of you being more of you. And I think as a developmental leader, to be able to identify that and help the person see it and self-actualize it and move on to be a greater version of themselves, is a huge challenge as a leader. So, and I know I'm straying away from the grit and resilience, but it comes back to the point of, if you know yourself and you know where your strengths and weaknesses are, and you authentically know them, like you're not faking it, you know, like, I mean, I probably spent a good 10 years of my career faking it until I really did figure out what my strengths and weaknesses are. And I felt like once I personally got to the point where I embraced those and capitalized on the strengths and then found good people to carry my weaknesses, that was kind of really when my resiliency blossomed, and I was able to like take on things that were scarier and more challenging, because I knew if I failed, you know, I kind of would know the context and how to grow from that. And so failure became less scary. My worry about what it would look like on the outside became less scary. And it really just came down for me of knowing I'm doing the right thing that's authentically me. And if this doesn't work out, then I just have to go be authentically me someplace else. So that's not really grit resilience, but I think in a way it was for me.
No, and I think you speak to a very good point, ma'am, that we don't traditionally do very well as physicians, which is learning how to take a knee, right? And not being running constantly. And it's even something that we brought up in the operator panel that Commander Chittick and Commander Stone emphasized as well. Being able, I guess, to refill your tank in some ways, and not always having to push. And so I appreciate that, because I think a lot of us, and especially a lot of women as well, we always feel the need to prove ourselves. And so we don't necessarily step forward with the confidence that it's okay to recharge our batteries, and it's hard to pour from an empty cup. Thank you for that.
And so, Dr. Gibbons, along the same lines, especially in light of all the things that have happened for in the political realm, and diversity inclusion has been a big push for the military this past year. What sorts of things that you had to deal with through your military career and now civilian career as a female physician in dealing with different kinds of issues?
I mean, you heard some of them, a lot of them have gone away. You know, I mean, duct tape in my belly during flight surgery course. I hope nobody's doing that anymore. But you know, it was all of it. It was like, I was going to get kicked out of a course if I chose to go pump, you know, like just being denied jobs because you might get pregnant. I think some of those things we still have to advocate for. I will say when I was in the soft community, there were a couple of organizations that did a really great job of career planning with their women. And so they were, you know, these were women that had, that a lot of money had been invested into training them in very specific areas. And so it wasn't like they were just going to throw them aside because they were expensive. They were expensive toys at this point. And so they did a really good job with trying to map out some career planning for them of like, well, if you are going to have a family, here's some good times to do it. Here's a school to do while you're doing that. And it's not perfect, but at least it's something. At least it's trying, and there will never be a right answer that's right for everybody. But I think the more we can acknowledge that life happens, and now let's figure out how to make the most of what is happening in life, that that doesn't have anything to do with whether you're a man or woman. It has to do with you're a human being that has life issues, and we as leaders owe it to those you know, around us to be able to adapt to life and make it fit within our organization. I think now in the civilian world, what I'm, you know, like there's still a lot of things that bother me. Like, you know, for example, it's like as co-founder of this, you know, company, we're getting preferential look from, you know, venture capitalists because of having a female, you know, founder, you know, like there's these things that, and I'm like, no, well, it should be because I'm a good company, not because I'm a girl, you know? So there's still things that frustrate me about positive, you know, pushing the female agenda a little bit. I still am a real believer in do a good job and select based on that. So I'm all over the place on this answer. I'm sorry. It really is kind of, I still am always not about empower women. I'm like, empower people to be their best self. And I'll stand by that.
Yeah, no, you know, personally, and I know there's lots of questions and, you know, interest in knowing more, especially about somebody with such a long career and lots of stuff that you've done. So we do have one more question for me, for you. This is from an anonymous or somebody in the group here, the people. So thank you so much for speaking, ma'am. How do you recommend finding that balance, especially early on in a career, between walking the quote unquote party line in the medical corps and making waves when something isn't right? Additional, do you have any advice to the folks just starting their careers for balancing career advancement with building and supporting your family?
So I'll split those into two. So the first one of like knowing when to rock the boat goes back to my like, know the money, know the resources, know the rules, and know them better than everybody else that you're going to go to and try and push whatever agenda it is that you're pushing. Because within that lies the beauty of what it is you're trying to do. You're trying to show them, yes, I understand all the reasons that, you know, I shouldn't do this, but here's the reasons why. And there's the tipping of the scale. And honestly, what'll happen is you're going to have leaders who, first of all, don't have the energy for it. Second of all, have other things that are more important. And you might have to acknowledge that and go sit down and shut up. But if it truly is something that you feel needs to be forward, sometimes you have to come at it from another direction. And that's not saying, you know, jump your chain of command. I really did try and inform my chain of command when I was going another direction. Because it doesn't work to burn bridges. It really doesn't. Like, don't light the house on fire and then walk out. You know, really try and come from several angles and help get various perspectives involved. And that will serve you well when you're trying to challenge the status quo. Balance for family life. I'm probably a horrible advisor on this. yeah, it's hard, you know, and it's a different answer for everybody on what's okay with you. I mean, and life definitely was different for me, you know, once I became a single parent. I did make sure I negotiated, I write the schedule. That's the number one advice I can give you, is if you can be the owner of the schedule, and everybody hates making schedules, it's a lot of work. But I found if I wrote the schedule, I I gave myself the crappiest shifts, but I gave myself the crappiest shifts so I could have what I needed otherwise. That's a tactical skill that worked very well for me. And I kind of used that moving forward of make myself the boss so I could decide when work was important or when it wasn't important. And that requires taking on some administrative burdens that actually increase your workload, but give you more control of your environment, if that makes any sense.
GSASEP is proud to be the premier continuing medical education source for military and federal emergency physicians. To purchase CME for the episode you just listened to, please click on the link in the show notes. The Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians promotes quality emergency care and enhances the development of emergency physicians who serve our nation from training through retirement. Learn more about our chapter at www.gsacep.org.